Hi, my name is David McGuffey, and today we're going to talk about Medicare and Medicaid. It's important to understand the distinctions between these two programs as you plan for your future. For one thing, misunderstanding these programs can cause you to lose opportunities. It can cause you to fail to plan for your estate. It can cause you to fail to purchase long-term care insurance. So you need to understand what the programs do and also what they don't do. This program is going to be a basic program. It is not going to tell you everything there is to know about Medicare and Medicaid. If you want to know more about Medicare or Medicaid, give us a call at 706-428-0888 or 1-800-241-8755. Another good place to go if you want more detailed information about the programs would be the Medicare.gov website. We will reference that several times during this program. And you can also go to the website for the Centers for Medicare Advocacy. Their website has a wealth of information on it. Now, the programs have been around since 1965, and this picture shows President Johnson signing the Medicare statute into law, and President Truman sitting next to President Johnson. He received the very first Medicare card. As we're thinking about the programs that are out there for individuals who need help, there are two primary entitlement programs, two primary welfare programs. There are other programs out there, so don't get me wrong. These are not the only things that are available for people. But the four programs listed on the screen are the four most commonly applied for programs. Two of them provide cash assistance to help you with things like paying your mortgage, paying your bills, paying for clothing, buying groceries, and then two of them will pay your medical bills. Keep in mind that the two that pay medical bills never pay you. They pay doctors. They pay hospitals. They do not pay you. Now, in this box, the headings at the top and on the left side tell you which programs are which. The box shows you that the two programs on the left, Social Security Disability and Medicare, are entitlement programs. You get them because you paid into the system. Those were deductions taken out of your paycheck. The two on the right, Supplemental Security Income, SSI, and Medicaid, are needs-based welfare programs. You get them because you're poor enough under the eligibility rules to qualify. And as we will go through this, you will see that poor enough under the eligibility rules does not necessarily mean poor or rich based on what you understand it to be. Certain assets are exempt and others are countable, so you have to look at the rules to see whether you're eligible. Medicare and Medicaid are very different programs. The Medicare program is a federally funded program, federally administered program. It should be uniform throughout all states. The Medicaid program is a welfare program. It's jointly funded by the state and federal governments, and it varies from state to state. I practice law in both Georgia and Tennessee, and the programs are very different in Georgia and Tennessee. Both programs will help you pay medical bills. They both help people who are aged, blind, or disabled. Medicaid is the principal government program funding long-term care. Medicare is a national health insurance program for people who are 65 and older, blind or disabled. It primarily covers acute care. Think about things that cause you to go to the hospital, cause you to go to the emergency room, or cause you to go to the doctor. Those are what we call acute care. Heart attack, stroke, broken bone. Think about things that can cause you a lot of grief but may not be things that would take you to the hospital, like Alzheimer's disease. That's not acute care. That is what we call long-term care. And long-term care is a range of services and supports that would help you meet your personal needs. So, for example, if you needed to help to get through the day, you needed help with bathing, dressing, using the toilet, transferring to and from beds, you were incontinent, or you needed trouble feeding yourself, those are not considered acute care and, for the most part, are not paid for by Medicare. Medicaid will help pay for them if you meet or if you fall within a class of assistance, and we'll talk about those later. Medicare is not tied to your wealth. It's not tied to the size of your income. It's not tied to the size of your savings account. There's an alphabet soup associated with Medicare. Traditional Medicare is called Part A and Part B. The Part C program, which is now called Medicare Advantage, is a private insurance option instead of traditional Medicare. Part D is your prescription drug coverage. Medicare is going to cover catastrophic injuries. It's going to cover hospitalizations, doctor visits, medical equipment. Who's eligible? People that paid into the system are eligible. You have to have paid into the system for 40 or more quarter hours. That's 10 years of work in a Medicare-covered employment setting. You also have to meet other eligibility criteria. You have to be 65 years or older, a citizen or permanent resident. If you're less than 65, you have to be disabled. You can get immediate coverage if you have end-stage renal disease or Lou Gehrig's disease called ALS. If you have any other disability, then you're probably looking at a postponement before Medicare will begin covering you of 29 months from the date you became disabled. The reason why it's 29 months, typically there's a five-month delay between the time you're disabled and the time you can begin drawing Social Security disability, and then Medicare begins 24 months after that for a total of 29 months. Part A of traditional Medicare is your institutional coverage. It's going to cover hospitals, hospice, home health care, and it will cover some skilled nursing care, but keep in mind it does not cover much skilled nursing care. It's the skilled nursing benefit is designed to get you out of the hospital quicker. It will cover a maximum of 100 days. Who's eligible for Part A? Most people who paid into the system will be automatically enrolled at age 65 and will pay no premium. If you did not pay into the system, if you did not work those 40 quarter hours, then you can buy into the Medicare Part A system by paying a monthly premium. In 2014, the monthly premium is $426. Part B is your medical insurance for your non-institutional coverage, such as doctors, outpatient hospital care, extended home health care services, durable medical equipment, and other items. And the Part B coverage does have a monthly premium associated with it. In 2014, most people will pay $104.90 per month. If you have employer-provided coverage, sometimes people do not sign up for Part B right away. If you have employer-provided coverage, then you probably got a letter which says that you have coverage which is as good as or better than Part B. You need to save that letter, because if you lose that coverage and you sign up for Part B later, then you would have a penalty tacked on to your monthly premium unless you have that letter to show that you were covered under the system or under an employer-provided policy. How do you enroll in Part B? You can enroll when you go to apply for Social Security. The open enrollment period begins 3 months before you turn 65, continues for 4 months after that. If you delay signing up, then there is a general enrollment period each year running from January through March 31st. Part D provides prescription drug coverage. It is essentially a catastrophic safety net. It will limit your individual liability to approximately $4,550 in 2014, plus the monthly cost of your premium for whichever plan you enroll in. You can go to the Medicare.gov website and compare different Part D plans. Open enrollment period currently is scheduled from October 15th through December 7th each year. You can change your plan at that time with coverage for the changed plan or new plan beginning on January 1st of the next year. So going through, just looking at the breakdown on how we arrive at $4,550 being your out-of-pocket spending in 2014, the initial deductible under a Part D plan is, for most plans, is going to be $310. And the different plans can vary, but they're supposed to arrive at approximately the same amount of spending based on a combination of your premium and deductibles and copays. But for most people, the initial deductible would be $310. Then there is, after you reach $310 in spending, it is a 75-25 split, with the insurance plan paying 75% and you paying 25% until spending reaches $2,850. And then there is a coverage gap where there is no coverage until total spending reaches $6,450. And when we crunch the numbers, as we've done below on this slide, you see that your total out-of-pocket spending, when we look at the coverage that you get between $310 and $2,850, total out-of-pocket spending would be $4,550 in 2014. That's a reduction from 2013. The reason why is we're seeing, after Obamacare, we're seeing the coverage gap close each year and until it disappears around the year 2020. Medicare supplements are designed to pay the copays and deductibles associated with the Medicare program. There are 10 standard plans, all regulated by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. There's a good booklet on the CMS website, medicare.gov, and it describes the different plans, what they provide coverage for. The plans are uniform, and as I said earlier, we have an alphabet soup. You have A through D, F, G, and then L through N. Now, if you've got a plan, most of the plans are going to pay the copays and deductibles. So if you go to the hospital, if you have an acute care problem, then most people who have Medicare and a supplement will end up paying nothing other than their Medicare and Medicare supplement premiums. Medicaid is filled with questions because Medicaid is confusing. Medicaid is part of the Social Security Act. It's Title 19 of the Social Security Act. It's jointly funded by federal and state governments. Approximately 60% of the funding comes from the federal government. Approximately 40% comes from the state. I say approximately because the richer states pay more, the poorer states pay less. Medicaid is means-tested. It is a welfare program. The fastest growing class of assistance is nursing home Medicaid. The reason why I mention the term class of assistance, or the phrase class of assistance, not everyone who needs help gets help. You have to fit within a class of assistance to get help under the Medicaid program. The courts, if you're confused about Medicaid, don't feel like the Lone Ranger. The courts have said that the federal and state Medicaid statutes are the regulatory equivalent of the Serbonian bog. That is a description of what John Milton described in Paradise Lost, if you've read that, a profound bog where entire armies have sunk. When I'm talking with people in Georgia trying to explain how confusing it is, I describe it as being like a walk through the Okefenokee Swamp at night with no map, no compass, no flashlight, no nothing. It's confusing. The principal document, other than the U.S. Constitution, U.S. statutes, and regulations, the principal state document describing what the states provide is called a state plan. The state plan is a contract between the state and the federal government where the states are saying what they're going to do and also what they're not going to do. It has to be submitted to the federal government for approval. Every state has a state plan. The state plan will outline many of their procedural rights and safeguards. And when we're looking to see whether the state is providing what it says it's going to provide, the document that we ultimately would look to is the state plan. Now, in the elder law bar, and most elder law attorneys are going to be the people you go to figure out how Medicaid works. The running joke is there are 10,000 rules, and they change every Friday. And the reason why is because we begin with the U.S. Constitution, and then we go to federal statutes, and then we go to federal regulations and federal manuals, and then the state plan, and then state statutes, and then state regulations, and then the state manual. And by the time we get to the end of it, there are 10,000 rules, and they change all the time. So if you've been listening, if you've been getting your advice from the neighbor lady across the street, then chances are not only was she wrong to begin with because she didn't know the rules, but she's probably also wrong because she remembers something that happened before the rules changed. One of the things that you need to keep in mind is Medicaid has no logic. You can throw logic out the window. If you are trying to get Medicaid, you have to follow the rules. You have to dot the I's. You have to cross the T's. Don't look for logic because frequently there is none. Eligibility is determined across three broad planes. First, we have categorical eligibility, then medical eligibility, and then financial eligibility. And when we're looking at eligibility, again, you have to fit within a class of assistance. When we're looking at long-term care Medicaid, that includes a length of stay requirement, which would be 30 continuous days in an institutional setting, which can include your hospital days. The applicant must be medically eligible, meaning you need help. It has to be medically necessary. It cannot be something like cosmetic surgery, which is discretionary and would be described as unnecessary. And the applicant must meet the financial eligibility criteria, which includes looking at income and assets. Now, again, classes of assistance tell us who gets help, and they also tell us who doesn't get help. And in the Medicaid world, you get help if you fall within a class of assistance, and if you don't, then you don't. If you're looking for the Georgia Medicaid rules, one of our websites is georgiamedicaidlaw.net, and we have a copy of the Georgia Medicaid manual posted there. But here I've given you a list of the classes of assistance in Georgia. And you can see, looking at the list, that we're going to take care of an adult disabled child, we're going to take care of people who need hospice, we're going to take care of people who are in nursing homes, we're going to help newborns. If you fall within a class of assistance, then we're going to help you, and if you don't, we're not. The basic eligibility criteria, you must be age blind or disabled. You have to make an application for other benefits. Medicaid always pays last, so that they will always require you to pay or apply for everything else that you might be eligible for. You have to meet citizenship and identity requirements. You have to have a Social Security number. You have to meet residency requirements. And you have to assign any third-party resources that might be available. For example, let's say you were injured in a car wreck and you have a right to sue the other driver. When you recover from that other driver, Medicaid wants to be paid back. They will have something called a lien against your recovery. And dealing with that lien is something beyond the scope of this program. Suffice it to say that if you're in that situation, you probably need to talk to someone who understands Medicaid. Nursing home Medicaid is the class of assistance that most of my clients will apply for, and the reason why is because it's the most expensive class of assistance, and as people age, and as they have chronic illnesses, many people need nursing home care. An applicant must be in a participating nursing home to get Medicaid. They must meet the length of stay requirements, and they must meet all other basic and financial eligibility criteria. I want to go back to they must be in a participating nursing home. Most nursing homes do participate in the Medicaid program. In fact, approximately 90% of all nursing home residents either are on Medicaid or will be on Medicaid during their nursing home stay. But not all nursing homes participate in the Medicaid program. There are a few out there that are private pay only, and there are some that only participate in the Medicare program. So you have to make sure that you're in a nursing home that participates in the Medicaid program. The Medicaid program will examine your estate to see if you're poor enough under the rules. And as they do that, there is an income cap. Georgia is an income cap state right now. There is some talk that that might change, but until it changes officially, you need to know that Georgia is an income cap state. Currently, the income cap is three times the SSI rate, the Supplemental Security Income Rate. In 2014, that rate is $721 per month. or a monthly income cap for the Medicaid program of $2,163. In 2013, that was $710, so the monthly income cap was $2,130. So as the SSI rate goes up, the income cap goes up. If you have even one penny more than that in gross income, you are not eligible for Medicaid unless you have a qualified income trust. Qualified income trust is a device that federal law requires the states to let you use. It comes from a federal statute. I put the statute on the screen. You only put income of the applicant into the trust. You do not put anything other than monthly income into the trust. At the applicant's death, the state's going to get anything that's still in the trust, and these trusts are only used in states where there is an income cap. The trust must be irrevocable. It cannot be backdated. It can be established by the applicant. It can be established by a guardian or by an attorney, in fact, under a power of attorney. Income must be placed into the trust during the month of receipt, and then payment for the applicant's medical care must be paid by the end of the month when the income is received. The qualified income trust can make four basic types of distributions. It can pay the personal needs allowance for non-veterans. That's going to be $50 a month under the current rules. For veterans or spouses of veterans, it could be $90 a month. It can also pay a spousal diversion if there is a healthy spouse, a community spouse who's entitled to some of the nursing home residence income. It can pay unreimbursed medical bills if they have been approved by Medicaid, and then it will pay the patient's cost share. One of the things to keep in mind, under the income side, Medicaid is a cost share program. Medicaid is not going to leave you, whether you have more than or less than the income cap, you're going to have to contribute your monthly income to your bills, your nursing home bill, before Medicaid will pay the balance of the bill. So Medicaid is not going to leave you money to pay life insurance premiums. It's not going to leave you money to pay to keep the water and electricity on at your house. Also, the qualified income trusts cannot pay bank fees or other expenses. If you have questions about Medicaid and the income rules, then you can call us or call an elder law attorney. On the asset side, these are very broad statements, but for a single individual, you have to have $2,000 or less in countable assets. For a married individual, you can have more. That changes each year. And unless an asset is exempt, it's probably countable. Some of the basic exempt assets would be your home, your furniture in the home. Medicaid is not going to make you have a garage sale to get your bills paid. You can have one vehicle, personal items, and then burial assets that are within the Medicaid limits. The Georgia limits for burial assets are confusing as of several years ago, and frequently people who do not see an elder law attorney will end up having problems getting Medicaid if they did not use care getting their burial assets. As of several years ago, Georgia combines three different types of assets in looking to see whether you're within the burial asset limits. Those include life insurance, prepaid burial contracts, and burial savings. An applicant for nursing home Medicaid cannot have more than $2,000 in countable assets. If there's a community spouse, then additional assets can be protected for the community spouse's benefit. A community spouse is anyone who's married to a nursing home resident and is not in a nursing home. So if you have a spouse, if you are a nursing home resident and you have a spouse who is at home in assisted living or any other setting where they're not in a nursing home, they're probably a community spouse, and they may be entitled to keep additional assets, and they may be entitled to keep some of the nursing home resident's income depending on what else is going on. Those are things you'd want to talk to an elder law attorney about. Ownership. Medicaid only looks at what you own or have a legal right to dispose of when they're determining what's countable. So if you live in your child's house, for example, your child's house does not count toward your Medicaid eligibility because you don't own it. If your child has a savings account and they've been helping you out, your child's savings account is not going to be a countable asset in determining whether you're eligible. Now, I say that with one caveat. If you gave assets to your child, we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, then there could be some transfer penalties. But as a general rule, if you don't own something, then it's not going to be a countable asset. Countable assets are countable if you own it or have a legal right to control its disposition. In other words, if you have a legal right to use it to pay your bills, then it's going to be countable. One of the things that sometimes confuses people, they are on joint bank accounts. Someone who is a joint bank account holder has a right to take all of the money out. So Medicaid says that the Medicaid applicant is presumed to own all of the money in the account. If you do not have any legal restriction from using the asset for your benefit, then it's probably a countable asset, unless it's expressly exempt. As I said earlier, there are higher income and asset limits when there's a healthy spouse. And in Georgia, at least this year, the community spouse's retirement funds are exempt. If you have made gifts, then there will be a penalty. If you have made gifts, then Medicaid will refuse to help you during a period of time. Now, how do we determine that? The Medicaid law has something called a look-back period. That's 60 months. It used to be a shorter period of time, but since 2006, it's been 60 months, and that is the period of time during which Medicaid can second-guess what you did. And as this picture on the screen demonstrates, if something is older than 60 months, then it's beyond the horizon. Medicaid cannot look at it. It's out of their view. But if it's within 60 months, they can see it, and they will go to the next step if you've made a gift, and they will calculate a penalty. The penalty is going to apply if you gave away something and didn't get equivalent value back. So if you make a pure gift to someone, then there would be a Medicaid penalty calculated. If you make a sweetheart deal to someone, some people are confused. They think they can sell their house for $10, and that's not a gift. You know that's not true, and Medicaid knows that's not true. The gift is going to be the fair market value of the asset reduced by what you got for it. So if your house is worth $100,000 and you sell it for $10, then you made a gift of $990. The penalty is roughly equal to the number of months of nursing home care that you gave away, and for that period of time, Medicaid will refuse to help you pay the bills. Prior to the Deficit Reduction Act of 2006, the look-back period was 36 months, so if you've heard other numbers in the community, if you were listening to the neighbor lady across the street, and she said 36 months, then she's listening to old rules or remembering old rules. Since that time, it's 60 months, and under the old rules, the penalty started immediately, period of disqualification started immediately, and under the old rule, fractions were dropped, meaning if you gave away less than the amount Medicaid penalizes for 1 month, they ignored the gift. So some people used to play fast and loose and used to give away less than the monthly Medicaid penalty amount, and it was ignored. Since February 8, 2006, the rules have changed. The look-back period for all transfers is now 60 months. The penalty that would be imposed for making a gift does not begin until the Medicaid applicant is otherwise eligible, meaning you've dotted every I, you've crossed every T to become eligible for Medicaid, and fractional gifts are not dropped. So Medicaid will consider every gift you've made in determining whether you should be denied Medicaid for a period of time. There are a few gifts that are not penalized. Transfers between spouses are not penalized. If you paid a valid debt, that's not penalized. If you spent money on yourself, that's not penalized. If you sold something and you got fair market value in return, that's not penalized. For example, if your house is worth $100,000 and you sell it for $100,000, then you did not make a gift and there's no penalty. We can also make gifts to disabled children, to a trust for a disabled individual under 65, or to a caregiver child, but those gifts are you have to follow the rules strictly, and if you don't dot every I and cross every T, then you could be in a world of hurt. So you would probably want to get with an elder law attorney first. Curing a penalty. A penalty can be cured by returning the gift, but you have to return the entire gift. So if you gave someone $50,000, you can't cure part of the gift anymore by returning $40,000. You have to return the entire $50,000. Now, remember those assets that I said were exempt, like your house? They are exempt until you die. When you die, there is something called Medicaid estate recovery, where the Medicaid program wants its money back, and they will come after those assets. What you have to keep in mind is those assets were exempt because Medicaid doesn't want you to be homeless if you get better. If you go to a nursing home and you get better, we want you to be able to go home, so we don't take away your house. If you get better and you go home, we want you to be able to get to the doctor, so we don't make you sell your car. But when you die, most dead people don't need their house. Most dead people don't need their car. So the state wants their money back, and they will come after those assets. Federal law requires estate recovery, but each state has two options and as they impose estate recovery. The first, the federally mandated minimum is they have to go after the probate estate. The federal statute allows states to go after anything that passed because you died, which would include life insurance and other things. Georgia law is confused. Right now, the Department for Community Health claims it can pursue expanded estate recovery. Most elder law attorneys in Georgia believe estate recovery is limited by statute to the probate estate. And so right now we have a situation where the state is making claims that most elder law attorneys would defend. And if you have a situation where you're uncertain, then you would want to talk to an elder law attorney. Also, if you want to plan your estate to minimize estate recovery or to qualify for Medicaid, then you would want to call an elder law attorney. Now, you can call our office at our 800 number, 800-241-8755. You can also reach us at 706-428-0888. There is a lot of other information out there. This program is not designed to tell you everything you need to know about Medicaid. It is a basic, broad overview of the Medicare and Medicaid programs. If you have questions or if you're trying to plan to become eligible for Medicaid, then you should call an elder law attorney. If you're not in our area, you can contact or you can go to the website for the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. That's naela.org, and they have a Find a Lawyer tool that you can use there to find an elder law attorney near you. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your feedback on this program. And as we put other programs up, we would use your feedback to improve things. Thank you for listening today, and we appreciate you, and you take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Please stand by.